This is Food for Thought. Call Carol at 866-823-1077. And now, it's Food for Thought.
Welcome back to the second hour of Food for Thought with Carol and Mike. We're live at the Beacon Building at 814 Elm Street, right in downtown Manchester. And talk beer the whole first hour. That was fun. Carl from Abel Ebenezer Brewery. And not to forget that they're going to be having a, what did he call it again? Second
anniversary rollout or something like that.
Launch. Or
yeah,
second
yeah there
launch.
You go. Second year launch.
On Saturday from 12 to 8. So that'll be fun. In Merrimack. Yes, that should be fun. So
it's great that we're able to support some of the new and upcoming businesses, because so many of them have a lot to offer. And before we introduce somebody else that fits into that category, I want to let you know the show is brought to you by Integrity Health Coaching Solutions in Bedford and Londonderry, integrityfit.com, and your places, Carol, the Red Arrow Diners, Manchester, Milford, and now, brand new off of Exit 5 in Londonderry with a drive-thru. It's the RedArrowDiner.com. So last weekend, you were up in Ogunquit.
Yes.
As was I with our respective partners, and we never really...
Right, we weren't together.
Paths
listeners.
Did not cross, but whenever we do go away for a weekend, Barbara's really good about researching, you know, where we're going to stay and where we're going to eat, and she never lets me down. So she said, what about this place, the Velveteen Habit? Thinking, well, tell me more about it. And of course, we open up and we look at the website and look at the menu, and sounds good to us. It's just different enough and looks like they've probably got some really fresh ideas using some tried and true methods, I think. But we'll find out for sure. Its owner is Ben Goldman, the Velveteen Habit, technically in Cape Natick, but it's easier to remember Ogunquit. It's just a few hundred feet, I guess, over the border. Just over 93, once you go through downtown, you take a left down, I think it's Berwick, right?
Down Berwick Road, yes.
Yeah. So their mantra is showcasing traditional techniques in a modern farmhouse setting. And it's interesting because, first of all, welcome. Good
Thank
to
you.
Have you.
Thank you very much for having us on.
You're very welcome. You put yourself in sort of in a tough spot because you are in a building that was occupied by a very much loved restaurant.
It was indeed.
Arrows. And James Beard, award-winning chefs, and the whole deal. So there's going to be people comparing you to the old guys, and you're the new guy. So you're going to be proving yourself for a while, I would guess. That's a challenge.
It's true, and we spent a lot of time trying to think about what it is we are as a concept versus what was there. And they were a tremendously successful restaurant. They've been around for 25 years and decided to move on to some other projects and some other places up in Portland and Boston. And we thought about it a lot, and we know that we probably don't want to compete on that same level of super fine dining and beautiful food and all that sort of thing, but we think we can do something that's a little more fun, a little more current, and a little more modern. And if we can bring it back to sort of this traditional old farmhouse style of food, which is something we really believe in, which is a lot of curing, pickling, fermenting, smoking, whole butchering in-house, we think it's something that will be different enough that people won't think to compare us. I would just think, hey, this is a really cool new restaurant.
Yeah, it would. I mean, we had fun. We really had a good time, and I think that counts for a lot. I mean, the food better be good, and it was. But as soon as we went in there, we were a few minutes early. Do we want to sit at the bar? Do we want to be seated right away? Well, let's see what's going on in the bar, which is the speakeasy, right?
Yeah, so the restaurant's designed to have a couple of sort of different spaces. The restaurant's the menu's available throughout the whole restaurant, but the bar is basically designed to be sort of an old-style 1920s kind of speakeasy. A lot of mahogany, a lot of dark copper, and a lot of our cocktails, which are very seasonal, obviously handcrafted. We'd make all the tinctures and bitters there in-house from our garden on property. And the idea of that is basically just to let people come in and hang out and have a couple of cocktails and then kind of head into dinner. The bar is really designed around some of our favorite styles of sort of alcohol, which are whiskey, rye, bourbon, moonshine, things that are fun to play with, a little bit more modern, you know, decent scotch list, that sort of thing. We think that's just a little bit more fun than, you know, just the standard kind of martini bar.
Yeah, and a perfect example of that is, I mean, I'm typically a margarita guy no matter where I go. Mm-hmm. And so your bartender, and I never got his name. I don't remember what it was.
He goes by Baker, and I think I am the only person in the world who calls him Jeff.
Okay. So I see a drink called the Victor Victoria, which, you know, has Cabo Wabo and then a couple other things that lean toward being a margarita.
Sure.
But it really isn't. And so I said, all right, I'll try this. I'll try something new. Put salt on the rim. I said, no, that's stupid. It wasn't designed for salt. And it was really good. And Barbara got, What did she get? She got the something What the heck is it? Oh, I can't think of the name of it. But it I think had Jameson in it. You know, speaking of, you know, fine whiskeys and stuff, we loved the drinks.
I'm glad you did. We we've got a couple of people in the restaurant who are just truly creative when it comes to making cocktails. And you know, given the fact that we do make a lot of things in house, you make the grenadine in house, you make all the mixes in house, which is really really fun. We make limoncello in house. We have an opportunity to really put things together and play with them. So it's a really evolving bar program, which is really kind of fun. And we know that people like their traditional, you know, drinks. People come in all the time, order vodka, blue cheese, olives. We have all that as well. But we always think it's fun to just nudge the market in a direction that might be a little more creative. And we think about that when it comes to our food. We think about that when it comes to our bar menu. We think about that when it comes to our wine program, where there is a level of comfort.
Yeah, you're sommelier too, right?
Yes, yes. And there's a level of comfort for sort of everything we do, but we really get excited about people starting to trust us and say, okay, if I like a margarita, would I like the Victor Victoria, which has got a little bit of chartreuse in it and something else that kind of pushes it into a little bit more of sort of an herbal direction, which is still really fresh and really sort of great for a warm summer's evening. But that's kind of how we get excited about just getting the market to be a little bit more playful, I think.
See, I love that. Now, when Daryl and I go out to dinner, we always go to the bar. That's just where we eat dinner. We just always do. It's our thing. And I always ask for a drink menu because I always like to look for something a little bit different because I don't really have a go-to drink, so to speak. I mean, I like my red wine, Cabernet, but, you know, I like to start usually with a drink, and they're always the same.
And we usually
boring
ask people,
things, like you said. So I can't wait to go.
Yeah, and we appreciate that, and we look forward to having you. And we typically ask people, what kind of base spirit do you like? And if people say tequila, maybe we ask them if they'd be interested in, you know, the Victor Victoria or so forth and so on. If they say gin, you know, maybe it's, you know, the word cocktail that we had for a little while or vice versa. But we like people to try things, and we have a sort of philosophy in the restaurant that we never really get offended if someone says, you know, it's not my thing, can I try something different? And it's why we do club service in the dining room, which is if you order a glass of wine, we show it to you, we pour you a taste, and to make sure you like it and you're happy with it, then we pour it for you. So we want people to feel like they can experiment and taste and have a little bit of fun without committing to something that they don't really know, because they, you know, we think our program is a little bit different than, you know, just the typical sort of name brand cocktails and name brand wines on the menu.
Your business partner is Brent Bouchon. Is that how you say
his name? Director of operations. Yeah.
You weren't, this was kind of plan B, right? You guys were going to open a wine bar in Boston, or at least I know you talked about
that. Sure. And you know, as with any, I think, startup business or restaurant, it pivots a million times before it actually lands on something. And I had grown up in New England. Brent's from Connecticut, so, you know, kind of knew the area as well. And this whole concept started a number of years ago, and I had always wanted to open a restaurant ever since I was a kid, and that's kind of where the name of the restaurant comes from. And the idea was something around wine. I'd studied wine for a long time, really excited about it. And Brent and I linked up on an online community called Guildsom, which is basically an online community for sommeliers and people who love
wine.
We met online. We joke around, we met online.
That's awesome.
And that was a number of years ago. And I posted a question because I was thinking about doing a concept in Portsmouth. I loved Portsmouth. I'd interned there when I was 18 in a small financial firm there. And it was a great town, tons of walking traffic, and they were just putting up a new property called Portwalk Place, which is a huge complex now, and it's been built out and rented subsequently. And I posed a question about some of the main wine laws, and I said, you know, it's a control state, so it's a little bit challenging. Does anybody really understand this market? And Brent kind of responded to my question and said, yeah, I've worked there. I know the market really well. What's up? And that was a number of years ago, and then we kind of kept kicking around the idea of a wine bar and, you know, maybe doing something different. He had been in between a couple of different places, and, you know, before we knew it, we had, you know, looked at 7 or 8 different properties all across New England. I mean, Newton, we lived in Acton for a little while. Portsmouth was a long place, and then, truthfully, we didn't really think a property of this magnitude was attainable, but after a little bit of sort of creative financial engineering, we were able to get it work.
Is that what you call it?
That was good.
Now, our last guest, of the Abel Ebenezer Brewer. Mm-hmm. He basically leveraged everything he owned to get this going, which I know a lot of entrepreneurs do. Was that, do you own anything besides the restaurant equity?
Unfortunately, the only thing that we own, probably me and my wife, is this restaurant.
Yeah.
And we kind of joke around. I have a ongoing joke with my father, who basically says, you can drown at 10 feet or you can drown at 100 feet. So you might as well go big. So that was sort of where that was.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're totally committed to it. And
absolutely.
You'll give every last drop of blood.
And that's what it takes. I mean, you know, banks don't like to support you unless they know that you're fully committed.
Well, the failure rate is so high, I mean, statistically. And you worked in finance, so you probably kind of get that.
I did, and I understand what banks say. I mean, yeah. they want to feel secure and that sort of thing, which I understand. And, you know, I also think that it sends a great message to people around, especially employees, when they know that, you know, you're maybe young, but you're taking a risk on something and you believe in them to help you. And I believe in them very much to basically execute on the vision of what this restaurant is. And they're a great set of people. And we think of sort of the management team in the restaurant as basically me and Brent, who's the director of operations and maitre d', runs the dining room, Chris Wilcox, executive chef Chris Wilcox, and my sous chef, Dan Haley, who is outstanding as well. And then my head gardener, Garrett Bent, who essentially runs the acre of kitchen garden, which supports essentially the whole restaurant.
I'm glad you brought that up. That was my next question. It seems there's a trend toward raising your own produce. I don't know if you know the name Rick Bayless, but he's kind of the king of Mexican food in Chicago and has been on PBS and all, you know, the Food Network and stuff. I interviewed him about a month ago, and he says that he grows about, on a 1,000 square acre parcel, a square foot parcel, mm-hmm. I should say, $30,000 worth of produce that he doesn't have to pay out. I mean, clearly he's paying people to take
the labor, sure.
Labor and everything. But and that's one thing I regret is I didn't take you up on your internet invitation to walk through the gardens, you know, with a glass of wine, because I was having too much fun with Baker.
Yeah, we really he's great. You can't get away once you get
talked
to him. Such an interesting character. But we encourage people to walk around. We want it to be a very open garden. We want people to see what we do. We want people to see the stakes in the ground, say basil and gerbil and other things too, and really feel invested in sort of what we're doing. And we, you know, we're not a restaurant that really talks much about organic or sustainable or biodynamic or local, or that's sort of not the language we use in the restaurant. We're much more principally driven. So we do things we think are right because they're the way that they're supposed to be done. And we try not to celebrate it too much. We don't want to stick in people's faces saying, you know, this came from 2 feet down the street and this was pulled this morning. And we think people who are excited about food will sort of understand that, you know, the stuff that we do comes from the backyard. And, you know, inviting people to walk around, they'll certainly understand that it's a big part of the restaurant without us having to really, you know, kind of jam it into people and make them feel like we're off-putting a little bit. And we love doing it. I mean, to your point about the cost of the product, it's definitely offset by the labor that's required to go into it, plus all the different material you need to actually support the garden. But for us, it's like, if we can do it, why not do it?
Talk about rebuilding the business that used to be called Arrows Restaurant. Is a 7-month program, wasn't it?
Yeah, so I closed in the property October 24th of 14, and we started construction basically the first week in November. And for anyone locally, I think everyone knows the winter was a little bit rough up here. So we ran into a lot of problems, and a lot of it was truthfully learning the building. You know, we didn't know when the propane was going to run out. So the propane runs out, and then the pipes freeze, and then you have to make the call to the propane company to come fill you up when everybody else is trying to call the propane company who's had a 4 or 5 or 6 year relationship with. So a lot of it was learning the property while trying to do all the renovation that we did. And we restored the farmhouse. We ripped it basically back to floors and walls and essentially brought in pretty much everything new light fixtures, brand new wiring across the whole building, new custom banquettes, new furniture,
whoa,
new art. Painted all the walls.
You got to go
inside.
It's beautiful.
Took the poly off the floor, which was, you know, a fun project, and rebuilt the whole bar bottom up. We pulled out everything that was there, and we rebuilt it for this whole sort of speakeasy style look, which was, and the project was fun, and, you know, it was a huge pain, as you would imagine, when you're doing it. And my wife gave me a picture when we opened, and it was a picture of me holding onto these sort of steel windows that we had installed to open the property up. And it was pretty nostalgic because although it had just ended a month ago, I was like, wow, we'll never do that again, in theory. And it was pretty emotional.
Can imagine.
I bet. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, it's funny you talk about the speakeasy. When we first got in there and sat down deciding what we wanted, just to make talk with Baker, I said, I'm looking around for TV. Did you get to watch the Triple Crown? Because it just happened. We left the hotel and came over to your restaurant. And he said, no TV isn't here. This is a speakeasy. Just like that, you know.
It's great.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. We had the Porterhouse for two. Mm-hmm. And I really like is it chimichurri?
It is chimichurri, yep. Yeah. Sort of Argentinian style,
yeah.
Sort of sauce/accoutrement.
Right. Yep. I'm generally not a condiment guy, if you can call it that, for a nice piece of meat like that. But I said, I got to try it. And it worked nicely.
Yeah, and the basis of the restaurant really was around this idea of sort of family getting together and really having a good time over food. And I grew up in a family that did the exact same thing. And sort of everything that I have sort of as a memory really revolved around dinner. And so this sort of family style things we do, and there are currently two. There's a Porterhouse for two, which is really fun. It's 2.5 inches thick and just over 2.25 pounds.
It's fun to wrestle with when you get down to the end.
It is fun to wrestle with.
Yeah. Carol knows.
And then we do a 2-pound whole roasted sea bass, which is really fun too. Ooh. And we're going to be introducing a third family meal option as well, on top of sort of the other sort of standard dinner plates we have. And that concept is kind of different, I think, for that market. And it was something we had to figure out how to do logistically, which was a challenge. But the uptake has been awesome. And we probably sell more of that Porterhouse than I think anything in the restaurant.
Hmm.
That's great.
Not surprising.
Let's let people know where you're located again.
So we're 37 at Gunquit Road. That's Cape Natick, but for all intents and purposes, it's basically a Gunquit. So we're 2 miles directly from downtown Algonquin Center, so about 2 miles right off the coast of Maine.
And like Mike said, it's not a far, I mean, under an hour.
From
you can
here,
get there.
From downtown Manchester, an hour, maybe a few minutes, depending on the traffic beyond that, and really easy to find. I mean, you get off at exit 7 from 95, head north for a few miles right through the center, and then left on Berwick Road. You find yourself crossing over 95 again, and then look on the right side for the Velveteen Habit, named by your wife?
Yeah, so we sat around our apartment. This is back in New York a couple of years ago. And we said, all right, we're going to do this. And I was like, okay, it's pretty scary. And she was like, let's go for it. You've always wanted to. And I said, okay, what are we going to call this thing? And she said, well, you've always wanted to do this since you were a boy. She's like, do you remember the story of the Velveteen Rabbit? And I said, well, yeah. I said, my mother used to read it to me. And of course, everyone kind of knows that story, at least I hope. And she said, well, it is the story of a boy who believes in something that's not real until it comes to life. So what about something like that? And then we kind of played off of that and thought the habit part was something that people do without thinking very much about it. And that's how I think about some of the restaurants that I've got memories at and things that we do together. And that was sort of how it was all born.
Nice.
Well, I'm sorry to say that our time is up, but boy, we sure learned a lot. Of course, I learned the most by actually experiencing it, but I can certainly recommend. I probably wouldn't have made the invitation for Benjamin to come here today had I not liked it as much as I did, because you really can't fake that.
Well, thank you very much. You're all very welcome anytime.
Well, I found a quote that I don't know if you made this on your website. It says, we are just excited to spoil people when they walk through the door.
That's exactly how we think about it.
Yeah, that's how I felt. Yeah, that was very cool.
I can't wait to go.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. I'm very excited.
All right. Thank you very much, Ben.
Thank you. My pleasure. Great try. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Thank you.
Coming up next, one of our favorites, Chef Patrick. And did I see he has food in hand?
I think he does.
He did promise he would, didn't he?
I think he did.
All right.
I think you're right.
So we'll come back with more of Food for Thought on the Pulse, WTPL, next.
Food for Thought returns after these messages on 107.7 The Pulse.
Welcome back. Food for Thought with Carol and Mike. We are live at the Beacon Building. We're at 814 Elm Street. And we had a great visit with Ben Goldman.
Wasn't it fun?
The Velveteen Habit. I can't wait to go check it out. I love the...
you guys will love it.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Really well.
Speakeasy lounge and food. Everything just sounds really, really great. And now we have, like Mike said, one of our favorite guests of the week.
Well,
Chef
thank
Patrick.
You very much. Yeah. I'm glad to hear I'm one of your favorites.
Yeah.
You know, so
we love having you on.
Yeah, yeah, I can't wait. I want to try that restaurant.
Yeah, because you were up there during the summer, right?
Yeah,
there?
Yeah. My in-laws have a house up there, so right on Long Beach.
Do you know where that is? Or
I don't. I've never been there, but I know where. I mean, I know where Cape Natick is, and I know where. Right. I also know where, you know, obviously Algonquin is, because we're right down the road. But
this is a place they just bought it. It was a place called Arrows.
Yeah,
which was James Beard award-winning restaurant.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
I wonder why they closed.
Well, the guys that owned it wanted to run a restaurant in a hotel in Portland. And, I mean, who knows why they really did, but I think that maybe after 25 years you just either get burned out or want to try some new challenges. It's going to be a whole new audience for them. So I'm going to guess that was part of it.
Yeah, James Beard Award winners are pretty prestigious. Yeah. So the highest award you can really get in the restaurant industry.
You've got four of them yourself, right?
I have like six. Yeah. It's old hat to me.
We are not worthy.
I used to work for James Beard. No, I'm just kidding.
Hey, you brought us some treats
going
today.
Going back to our cooking 101 series, I guess, if you will, with my Garmanger class. Last week we did sandwiches, right? And I know I talked a little bit about it when I called in, but I wanted you to taste them because I love this section of it. Because you know, you go to a restaurant and you always get the same stuff, everybody's got the same things, and so what do I do in my class is to show them how to make different ones, so with different fillings and different spreads. So I did you guys little sliders, and I did which this one right here with all the Italian cold cuts, and then there's fresh buffalo mozzarella on there, which isn't normally part of it, but it's also a tempignon spread. And what we have is called a muffuletta sandwich, and you'll see that in kind of Louisiana cooking, you know, French style cooking down that style. I also did what's called a pan bag net. Okay, so what it is, it's a different take on like a tuna. It's got cucumbers, it's got black Guatemala olives, tomatoes, it's got roasted red peppers. I used a little bit of white balsamic vinegar. Okay, and some a little bit of salt, pepper, a little bit of garlic, but the light white balsamic makes it sweeter, so it's like a vinaigrette rather than that mayonnaise-y type of you know tuna. Like a lot of people are like, well, I want tuna, but I don't want to eat all the mayonnaise and that. So there's this kind of light, so it's kind of good. And you, even if you took it off the bread, you could still eat it on a salad or something.
Let me ask you about the tuna, chef, if I could. Do you prefer like a white, less fatty albacore?
In water.
I can't tell by looking at this what it is. But
that's exactly what it is.
Okay. It's a little darker color, so I'm going to guess it's what you did with it.
Yeah. It's got the white, you know, water, fresh water packed, you know, tuna what I prefer those pouches now that they have.
Really?
Instead of
Why is that? Aren't they more expensive?
I feel like it's just kind of, you get that metal taste.
We do those at the diner too.
Yeah,
the packs.
And in the packs, I think it seems to be a little bit fresher. Obviously, you know, if you are at the restaurant, you could order fresh tuna and grill it and cook it off that way, and then flake it to make your tuna. So that's how I would ultimately prefer it. But you know, like I said, you have those fresh packs nowadays. They seem like they're better. I don't know. I guess
that's what we use.
I'm gonna try that.
Yeah. All right. We started getting them in restaurants and things like that too. So I made that pan bag net. But then the other one too is I kind of did the wrap, the tomato wrap. And instead of using mayonnaise or other thing, the other thing you use is hummus. I put spinach hummus in there, grilled zucchini, grilled summer squash, roasted red peppers. And I also put some sprouts in there, and then the buffalo mozzarella cheese, and kind of wrapped it all up. And
that's healthy for me.
Yes, yeah, then that's exactly what I was thinking of. You know,
thank you, Patrick.
You could do that, Carol.
And it's
what?
You could do that,
right?
And a lot of people, you know, like I said, you don't realize it's a nice filling, moist sandwich. But it's all vegetables. It's just got a little bit of buffalo mozzarella, that fresh mozzarella cheese in there. It's just great idea, summer ideas. You've got, your garden out there today. You go out back and you're growing zucchini, summer squash, cucumbers, all of that stuff. You can make a sandwich out of it. It's very simple, very easy.
We did last night, Barbara did. I mean, this is, you know, nothing big to you because you're an experienced chef. Have you ever done a spaghetti squash, Carol?
I love spaghetti squash.
I did, but I messed it up. So
yeah.
Just say no.
Okay.
How was it?
It was fantastic.
Yeah,
it was great.
It comes out good. The way I do mine is I usually cut it in half.
That's what you did, face down.
Yep, scoop the inside out, and then what I'll do is I'll chunk up butter and I'll put it in the middle with some wine.
Okay.
Instead of doing face down, make it like a bowl, and then throw it in the oven, let it roast, and then it all steams out, and then you just kind of remove the spaghetti squash, but you get that buttery wine that mixes with it, salt, pepper, a little simple garlic.
That's a great idea. Yeah. We'll try that next time.
Yeah, yeah, but it's great. I love spaghetti squash.
We didn't do it with pesto. We just had some jarred sauce. I'm sorry to say, but it was actually good.
Yeah.
And the texture is, if you do it right, it's al dente, I think. Yeah, but if you overcook it, it clumps up. So
see, that's what I did.
You overcooked
mine.
If you do it, it kind of gets mushy and kind of you know, doesn't have that spaghetti texture to
you'll,
it.
Yeah, you'll lose the stringiness to it. But
you almost just want to touch it, like, you know, even though it's hot, you just kind of squeeze it. Should have some resistance to you, but not totally mushy like you would expect butternut squash to be or something like that.
I'm thinking that a pesto might really go.
Pesto would go with that sauce. Yeah, yeah. I usually do mine simple, just like I said, the butter, even like Parmesan cheese and butter, and then maybe salt and pepper inside of that. You know, kind of treat it like it is spaghetti. You know. And it works out very well. But, yeah, no, I love spaghetti squash.
But this is really healthy and great flavors.
Delicious.
I mean, I'm not a Sprouts guy.
Yeah.
But you know what? I can eat them this way.
Yeah. It's you know, and it's something different. Like I said, you know, I try to get the students' mindset to think outside of the box. Like I keep saying, you know, use local fresh ingredients, obviously, as much as possible. But like I said, you know, have a creative menu. Also cross-utilize. You know, like I said, a lot of these ingredients are in each one of the sandwiches. So when you own a restaurant and you have a sandwich menu, and you're, you know, like if you got different ingredients for each sandwich, that's just going to cost you a lot of money inside the restaurant industry. But if you do what's called cross-utilization and you're using cucumbers here, you use it 3 or 4 or 5 times out of your menu.
Exactly.
You know, it cuts down on your food cost as far as that goes. But it doesn't take much to have all these ingredients on hand and create creative sandwiches.
Now, these slider rolls, the rolls themselves look
yeah,
really
generally
good.
These ones, I did my slider rolls for you folks, because you guys just like a little you know, portion so you can try. Right. I don't want to give you a whole sandwich.
Why not?
Okay, next time I will. but generally, these two sandwiches, like especially that Pam Bagnette with that tuna, you should do like on a crusty roll and kind of dig out the bread, like I was, you know, saying, and kind of pack it inside there. And then, and like I said, that's healthy too. I mean, there's no oil into it. It's tuna's very healthy for you. You've got all the vegetables, and you're just using a little bit of vinegar, the balsamic vinegar, which adds a little sweetness and a little dynamic to it.
Because albacore is a little drier, how much of the water do you wring out, or do you not wring much out?
I wring most of it out.
Right. So you don't want any of that to keep it moist?
No. You don't want to keep the water in there because it'll get too wet, because you're going to add that balsamic to it anyway.
Oh, right.
So.
Okay.
Yep. So, and then, like I said, the muffaletta I created.
Now, why do they call it muffaletta?
I don't know the back end of it. Maybe it's in here. I have it.
It's got a huge book called, Garde Manger,
and it's Art and Craft of the Cold Kitchen. So this is the class that I'm in now. So I decided to bring it in, you know, and say, oh, students, did you have your book today? So I want to get you a copy of this, by the way, because these are great. I mean, if you take a look at this, we did sandwiches next week. We just already started 2 days ago. We started our curing section. So we made graph.
There's muffaletta. Maybe it tells the background.
Oh, there it is.
Maybe it tells the story there.
Oh, yeah. Nope, just tells you how to make it.
Damn it.
But I'll take a look at it. But, I mean, and if you take a look through this, I mean, there's a lot of just
well, it's
got to
be French
sandwiches.
For something.
Oh, yeah. There's the Pam Bagnette right there.
That's got to be a $50 book. I mean, that's beautiful.
Oh, yeah, this textbook for
textbooks are ridiculous.
It's more of a textbook for the students, but it tells you a lot. But, you know, like I said, I like to, for people who are foodies that really like to learn about this stuff, and I see your book sitting here, I like to put this on, you know, I'll get a copy for you because it really explains the whole background.
Add to our Food for Thought library.
Are you a cookbook collector?
I love
Carol?
Cookbooks. Yep.
Even if you never
love
make
them.
Something out of any given book, they're so beautiful to look at.
I love them. For some reason, you know, Sam's Club always has a great selection of books.
Yeah, they do. I did notice that.
I always go to the book section, and, you know, they always have some nice hardcover cookbooks, and, you know, I love them. I love them. I have a ton of them.
Yeah, I have a ton of cookbooks too. All, you know, and it's just it's good to have a reference. You know, I mean, I know a lot of this stuff you can get online nowadays, but I mean, it's always it's kind of like, oh, look at this, it's on my shelf.
Yeah,
you know,
if it isn't grease spattered, it's not absolutely worth having.
I mark in mine too. I put plastic over mine.
So if I'm cooking and I take a look, I just use this as a guide. Mm-hmm. You know, and the students obviously, when you have students, they want a recipe to learn from because it's easier, so they can follow the steps. You know, and you have 12 students in class, he's trying to hear chef, and you're going back and forth, bing, 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 you know, and then you taste everything 1,000 times, you know, so, which is why I have my girlish figure, you know, so, but it's neat. It's just a great reference, but it, even before this book, I mean, it explains like the process of it, like we're doing curing this week. So we started curing bacon, gravlax.
We're making our own gravlax.
Is, you know, like lox and bagel, salmon.
Oh, okay.
Right. So we cured that. So some of these days will take about 11 days to cure, and then we'll take them out, we'll smoke them. We made pastrami.
What is the process of curing them?
Curing is, and there's more scientific, you know, explanation to it, which is what I put in here. But the process of curing or brining something is to soak it in either a salt water solution or soak it in or cover it with salt. And you use different types of salts for the curing process, and it's called denaturing. You denature the meat. What you do is you take in that moisture, and through osmosis, you're taking that moisture, you're pulling out of the cell wall. It's going to grab that salt, bring it back into the cell wall, and that's what cures your food. You know, it's very scientific. I explain it like that, but it kind of cooks it. You know, without the process of heat is what it does. So
without the process of heat.
Yeah, and it's a way of preserving your food. So when you start talking about preserved foods, you think about the history of it. Some of the earliest preserved foods were people on boats before we had refrigeration catching this fish. They would fillet them, and they would soak them in the salt water. Then they would take and dry it out on the rocks just so once it dried out, they would save it. Or if hunters and gatherers would go and like, let's say, shoot a deer or whatever, or kill a deer. I don't know what different things back then. They're not going to eat the whole deer, and they want to save the meat. So they would build camps and fires and get a nice smoky fire, lay the meat next to the fire. It would keep the bugs and all that sort of stuff away from it. But also, when they started finding out it gives flavor, and it would also preserve it.
Is that similar to dry aging, when you see a steak that's been dry aged or whatever for 52 days?
Is it
kind of that concept?
It is kind of that concept. And dry aging and any type of aging also adds flavor, but it also adds tenderness to it. So if you were to dry age something, you say like 45 day age, you always see those in the meat houses and stuff like that.
Right.
It's very simple. You get like a little tub, you poke holes in it, and you kind of salt it down a little bit, and then you put it in the back of your refrigerator and let it sit for 45 days. You take it out, it's going to lose some moisture. It's going to have that dried that dried look to it.
Isn't it green sometimes?
It is, but then you cut that portion off, and then the inside, hasn't had any spoiling, but the flavor adds some flavor cut characteristics. We used to do it at restaurants all the time, and it just, for some reason, just adds this great flavor to a steak.
It adds about $20 to the cost of a steak,
exactly.
Too, in most places I've been.
Yeah, because you're taking the cost of what you trimmed off and putting it back into the steak, you
know. Of course.
Because it's all waste and stuff, but it adds flavor. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we teach them how to cure. And of course, nowadays, when we're eating cured meats, I mean, it's the deli meats that you're eating. It's, you know, we're eating it because it's flavor, because it's, you know, you got some, you get flavor and taste and everything like that, the curing and the smoking bring to what we have today rather than preserving. And we make salami. We'll make salami. I've made mortadella with them.
Have you?
Yeah, we're making sausage.
Tell me you're not making head cheese, please.
No. I've never made that, but
yeah. I was describing it to Carol one day.
Yes, it didn't sound good.
Then we Googled it, and it's, God, well, I don't know if that's a French-Canadian thing, because my dad loved it when I was a kid. French-Canadian. I said, no, Dad, you can't be eating that.
Oh, well, even worse, I don't know if you've ever seen on TV before, and like some of the food networks, you know, like that, what's that show with Andrew Zimmern? Eats the bizarre foods.
Bizarre foods.
Mm-hmm. And he went to Italy, and he had this cheese where literally the cheese, to ferment the cheese, they let it get maggots in it. And I'm no kidding. And then they cut it open, and it's a soft cheese, and you could see them moving in there, and they eat this cheese. They spread it out, you know, like kind of like just pick through it and eat it. And it's supposed to be this fantastic cheese that people have had. And that's how, you know, like I said,
he used to be my one of my favorite guests. I guess I kind of asked for it, though. Talked about head cheese.
Yeah, no, it's one of those things. I couldn't believe it. I don't know if I would try that.
Stuff that he eats.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, but what? I mean, we do our cheese making section, too. And you like I said, you know, cheese is age. You know, the best part about it is letting them age. We usually cryovac ours, so there's no mold or anything that grows on it. But the mold's fine. You can cut off the mold and eat it. It's supposed to do that, you know. So
well, what about jerky? Which is just another same variation thing of cured meats.
That's it. It's cured and dried. And so we make that too. You generally use for jerky a more I would say less fatty, you know, cut of meat.
Buffalo jerky is very popular.
Yeah.
That's a fairly lean meat.
Yeah, right? And you just you marinate it in whatever flavor you want and then smoke it or dry it.
Yeah.
You know, and we just get a dehydrator and dry it and make jerky all the time.
Drive through northern Michigan, which is where I'm from. Well, I'm from Detroit, but upstate. Yeah. When you drive along the highways during the summer, about every 50 feet there's a stand selling any kind of jerky you can think of.
Yeah. It's I always see in the story that the guys I brew beer with love jerky. We go on our fishing trips and things like that.
Guy stuff.
So we do make jerky.
You brew beer?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
I've been brewing beer for 15 years.
I caught that.
Oh, yeah.
Did you hear the segment
earlier? I did. I was listening to it, and I was like trying to get down here to see if I can catch them. I love Founders beer, by the way. It's one of those beers that
did you see the baby label controversy?
No, I didn't. I was listening to it.
I'll pull it up on my phone here. We should take a break.
We do. You're listening to Food for Thought. We're in studio with Chef Patrick Hall. He brought in some delicious sandwiches. And stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Food for Thought returns after these messages on 107.7 The Pulse.
Welcome back, everybody. The final few moments of Food for Thought. Been a fun day. We've covered beer, new restaurant in Maine, and talking to Chef Patrick Hall right now, who brought us some nice sliders and an excellent wrap, which is good and healthy enough for you to eat, Carol.
I even had a bite of that tuna, and that is really good.
That's healthy as well, too.
Different
taste. No fat
in
it whatsoever, yeah.
It's very good.
And it's all vegetables.
I'm supposed to grill a steak tonight on my big green egg, but now I got this, I'm kind of second-guessing it. Maybe I'll let it dry age another day in the fridge. I don't know. Hey, we're brought to you by New England Coffee, the official coffee of Food for Thought, and Fallon's Furniture, the official decorator of the Green Room.
There we go. And Chef Patrick.
Yeah.
So what is on next for, like, what do you do next?
So next we're starting
our whole curing
section. But then and that goes a long while, too, because the students will come in. And like I said, all you curing is you measure out the salts. So, I mean, you have different salts that we use for curing the meats, okay? And there's some are higher in nitrates or nitrites. What the nitrates and nitrites do is they kind of preserve it, you know, differently. They make it, you know, like nitrates will preserve it quicker, you know, than nitrites. So they're not really good for you, those salts, but you use them in just very little in the curing process, and we actually dye it pink. So it's a pink salt, and it's dyed pink for a reason, not dyed, but I mean, however they color it. So you don't use, I mean, I know you have pink salt that's very edible.
Himalayan salt.
But this stuff is pink, so you don't use it as salt in your food, because too much of it could you know do stuff to you. But when you use it for
kill you,
eventually
we'll start there.
Hey, they say, you know, don't cook with MSG. I love it. No, oh, I know. I'm just kidding. But it's one of those things that you that we use as an agent. You know, it's just the same thing as meat tenderizer. You ever go to the store?
Oh, okay.
And that's what that does. So the meat tenderizer, that's what makes it tender, is because it has its higher nitrates inside the salt, and it helps that DNA process.
Right, what if I want to make bacon at home and I want to try my hand
very simple
curing? I just need to know what cut of pork to get.
Yeah, but you get pork belly.
Pork belly.
It's funny. I just went to Market Basket for my class because I didn't need a lot of it because we don't have that many people in class. So I got a little small section like this.
They typically carry it?
They had it. Yeah. They have a lot of stuff. They have hog casings there too. So when you make sausage.
They do?
Yeah. For making sausage and all that sort of stuff. And it's very simple to get into sausage making and meat curing and all that stuff at home. And it's safe. A lot of people are like, oh, no. You know, I don't trust my, but no, it's safe. The best thing to do if you want to get into making bacon or curing your meats at home. Obviously, get some either plasticware or stainless steelware that's larger. Mm-hmm. Research your salts that you want to use in your flavorings. For the nitrates and things like that, try a batch. Get one of those pieces, cover it. It's going to draw the water out of it. I give you a guide right here so you can actually try it. And then once put it in a safe place in your fridge so it's not going to drip on anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But take that piece, take it, rinse it, and then you have a smoker, and that's it. It's very simple, very easy. But it's also the best way to do things because it's homemade.
Sure. Now, what if I want to infuse it with maple flavor? Would that be some kind of a spice that I would use, or would you actually use maple syrup?
You could use like maple sugar, because other parts of brine too is you also add sugar too to kind of off balance of the sweet and saltiness too. And you could infuse your sugar with some of the maple. Or what I do is sometimes after it's done curing is I crack black pepper and I'll put maple on it. And then I'll throw it in the smoker and let it smoke. So it'll be like hickory maple, black pepper, crusted bacon.
I think you need to make that.
I think I should.
Come to Shaker. We'll make it together. I got a whole pork belly.
I need to come up a day and just shadow you when you're not, you don't have the kids around.
Yeah, no, it's fun. It's, like I said, you'd actually even love it more when the students are there. So
I suppose
they like new people.
They can do the dishes.
Someone new, exactly. Now he's thinking, but it's very simple. Like I said, pastrami, you get brisket, you soak it in that brine. It takes takes 8 to 11 days, and you soak it inside the fridge. Let it soak in that pink salt. We'll kind of get that pink, put pickling spice and stuff in there, and then you could use it without it crusted as corned beef. You take half of it, rub it down with cracked black pepper and juniper berries, and smoke it, and take it out, and you just made your own pastrami, and it's the best.
Okay. All right, so I brine my turkey every year. I only do it for a day. Is that enough?
Because you don't want to fully brine that, because then you'll get over salted. So there's certain things like turkey and things that are more delicate, can be easily over brined. So, but brining will add moisture to it too.
Oh, we hate to kick you out. Now you brought us food.
I know.
That's fine. That's what I'm here for.
But we always learn something with Chef Patrick. It's always fun.
And I'll keep bringing a lot of our subjects. We'll do each class separately. Wait till we get to my Italian class.
I hope you grade on the curve.
I do.
You're listening to Food for Thought. Up next is Kale and Company of Sleep. We'll see everybody tomorrow. Comedy Cold Cuts.
Bye.